Okay, hi. I decided to change my title slightly to more reflect what I'll be discussing. What I'll be talking about is the relationship between neutrinos and the production of the elements during the evolution of the universe. And obviously, I will talk about the R process as a major part of it. So let me start from the beginning of the universe. A few tenths of a second after the Big Bang, you know, the universe contained lots of photons, electron positron pairs, and neutrinos and antineutrinos, and a relatively small number of neutrons and protons. All these particles were at the same temperature of about several MeV corresponding to that time. And the weak interaction of electron neutrinos and antineutrinos and electrons and positrons with the free nucleons was very sufficient so that the neutron to proton ratio closely follow the chemical equilibrium value for the corresponding temperature. However, as the universe expanded and cooled, these weak interaction rates quickly dropped to a point that after which the weak interaction would cease to be efficient in interconverting neutrons and protons. And at this point, the neutron to proton ratio would freeze out at the chemical equilibrium value for the freeze-out temperature. Now, the expansion of the universe shortly after the Big Bang was governed by the energy density of photons, electron-positron pairs, and neutrinos and antineutrinos of these all relativistic species. And a universe with more neutrino species contributing to its energy density would cool down to a fixed temperature in a short amount of time. Consequently, for such a universe, the weak interaction would cease to be efficient at a higher temperature, and the neutron to proton ratio would freeze out at a higher value. Now, because after freeze out, the majority of the neutrons were incorporated into helium-4 before they could decay. So a higher neutron to proton ratio at the freeze out would give rise to a higher helium-4 abundance. Therefore, a very accurate determination of the primordial helium-4 abundance through observations can be used to constrain the number of neutrino species that contributed to the energy density of the universe during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Now, perhaps a very conservative limit, you know, by using the current trusted determination of primordial helium abundance would be that the number of contributing neutrino species during Big Bang nucleosynthesis is less than 4. Well, the Big Bang nucleosynthesis lasted for about the first 3 minutes or so. Now, all it did was to produce about 76% of hydrogen, 24% of helium-4, and the traces amounts of deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7. And essentially, all the other elements of the periodic table were produced later by stars. Now, these elements were ejected into the interstellar medium when stars died. And as a new generation of stars formed out of the enriched interstellar medium would start a new cycle of stellar birth, stellar evolution, and nucleosynthesis, and chemical enrichment. Through this cosmic cycle, the universe was provided not only with more varieties of elements, but also with increasing amounts of the elements above hydrogen. When the solar system was formed about 10 billion years after the Big Bang, the primordial composition of about 76% of hydrogen or protons and 24% of helium-4 by mass was changed to about 71% protons, 27% of helium-4, and 2% of heavier nuclei. So in other words, stars convert protons into helium-4 and heavier nuclei. And as helium-4 and heavier nuclei, everybody knows that they consist not only of protons, but they also consist of neutrons. So effectively, stellar nucleosynthesis turns protons into neutrons. But this can only be accomplished by weak interaction, and therefore must involve neutrinos. The first kind of stellar nucleosynthetic processes is fusion. which of course is also the energy source for stars. For example, it is well known that the sun shines because effectively four protons and two electrons are converted into helium-4 in its core. During this process, two electron neutrinos and about 27 MeV energy are released. And the detection of these solar neutrinos by a number of experiments has not only established the operation of fusion reactions inside of the sun, they also has led to, you know, a discovery of a great piece of evidence for neutrino oscillation, because all these experiments tend to indicate that electron neutrinos can oscillate into mu and tau neutrinos. However, fusion as a source for energy and a process of nuclear synthesis is limited by the nuclear binding energy. And because the ion group nuclei are the most tightly bound, no more energy can be released by fusing these nuclei. So the elements above the ion group must be made by some other processes. And one such process is the R process, which stands for the rapid neutron capture process. Now, during the R process, neutrons are rapidly captured onto some kind of C nuclei to make very neutron-rich progenitor nuclei far away from stability. After neutron capture stops, these progenitor nuclei successively beta decay towards stability and give rise to the stable nuclei above the ion group, as well as the long-lived actinides such as thorium-232, uranium-235, and 238. And obviously, these elements are very important, not only, you know, because they exist, but they also give us political troubles, right? These days, weapons of mass destruction is a big issue. When for the R process, you know, perhaps we would have much less to deal with. Clearly, a very large neutron number density is required for the R process. And this very large neutron number density may be provided in supernova. A supernova occurs when the ion core produced by fusion in a massive star collapses into a compact neutron star. The formation of a neutron star represents the most dramatic conversion of protons into neutrons, because a total of about 10 to the 57 protons are converted into neutrons over a time scale of order 10 seconds. Now, an energy release of order 10 to the 52 ergs in electron neutrinos is associated with this neutronization event. And, you know, my standard joke here is that it doesn't matter if you know what an erg is, you know, 10 to the 52 has lots of zeros. So basically, electron neutrinos coming from neutronization of the original ion core would take away 10 to the 52 ergs. However, this amount of energy carried away by these neutronization electron neutrinos is only a small fraction of the neutron star gravitational binding energy, which is several times 10 to the 53 ergs. Most of this energy must be released in neutrinos and antineutrinos of all these three flavors, because these guys are produced inside of the neutron star through electron-positron pair annihilation and a nucleon-Bronstrom. All these neutrinos can have neutral kind of scattering on nucleons inside of the neutron star. However, because the neutron star is very hot and dense when it's created, all these neutrinos have to diffuse out of the neutron star on a time scale of about 10 seconds. However, because only the electron neutrinos and antineutrinos can have charged current captures on neutrons and protons, respectively, these two neutrino species can stay in thermal equilibrium with the neutron star matter down to lower temperature than the mu and tau neutrinos and antineutrinos. In fact, because there are more neutrons than protons inside a neutron star, the electron neutrinos can stay in thermal equilibrium with matter down to even lower temperature than the electron antineutrino. So when these neutrinos emerge from the neutron star, the typical average energies are about 11 MeV for the electron neutrino, 16 MeV for the electron antineutrino, and 18 MeV also for the mu and tau neutrinos and antineutrinos. Now these numbers, as George has said in the previous talk, are not very exact. However, this energy hierarchy between very different neutrino species is quite robust. And the reasoning is just because the different kind of ability for these neutrino species to exchange energy with the neutron star matter. Now the luminosities for the average luminosity for all these different neutrino species, they're about the same, but they could vary, you know, within a factor of two or so. And a neutrino species with a higher average energy also tends to have a higher luminosity. Well, near the neutron star, the temperature is about several MeV or so, and the material there is essentially dissociated in neutrons and protons. As the neutrinos from the neutron star essentially free stream through this material, a fraction of the electron neutrinos and antineutrinos can have charge current captures on the neutrons and the protons respectively. And these interaction processes will then determine the neutron to proton ratio of this material. As we have seen, the electron antineutrinos producing the neutron have higher luminosities and average energies than the electron neutrinos producing the protons. So this material tends to be neutron rich and have a large neutron number density. And of course, because this material is also being heated by absorbing these electron neutrinos and antineutrinos, it eventually will expand away from the neutron star as a so-called neutrino-driven wind. And the wind material obviously will cool during its expansion. And when the temperature drops below about 1 MeV in the wind, neutrons and protons begin to assemble into helium-4, and eventually this will consume all of the protons, as George has discussed earlier. And the neutrons and the helium-4 left over are then converted into some kind of seed nuclei around the mass number 90 or so before charge, you know, Coulomb barrier will eventually stop all the charged particle reactions at a temperature around 0.25 MeV. And at this point, if the temperature of the wind material drops further, neutrons will start to be captured rapidly by the seed nuclei, and our process can occur. So I want to emphasize here is that a minimum requirement for an R process to occur in this wind is that the initial neutron to proton ratio of this wind material must exceed unity. And this depends on the electron antineutrinos having a sufficiently higher luminosity and average energy than the electron neutrinos. However, as we have seen, the mu and tau neutrinos and antineutrinos, they have the highest average energy and the luminosity. So if you can prove that the R process actually occurs in this environment, then any oscillations of the mu and tau neutrinos into the electron neutrinos would be severely constrained. As we have seen, a major role of neutrinos in nuclear synthesis from the Big Bang to supernova is to determine the neutron to proton ratio. And these neutrinos actually can also directly participate in nuclear synthesis, you know, in regions of a supernova where actually, you know, nuclear burning is not very overwhelming, because normally neutrinos only interact weakly and their ability of making new stuff is very limited by their rates. And nuclear reactions normally occur, you know, much faster. If nuclear reactions are going on, they will overwhelm the neutrino reactions. But if you go further out in the envelope of the star where things are cooler, then neutrino potentially could contribute to the production of some very interesting rare species of the elements. For example, neutrino spallation on carbon oxygen in outer layers of a supernova could produce a significant amount of lithium and boron. And also, neutrino spallation on neon-20 actually can account for all of the fluorine-19 in the universe. And just for your information, fluorine-19 is commonly used in toothpaste to prevent tooth decay. All right, so these kind of neutrino spallation processes of producing these rare species are actually very similar to the production of the very rare elements lithium, barium, and boron in the interstellar medium. And because lithium, barium, and boron are very easily burned at relatively low temperature, it is commonly believed that major production of these elements actually occur through interactions of the very energetic cosmic rays with the abundant helium-4 nuclei, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen nuclei in the interstellar medium, because interstellar medium is very cool. And an interesting thing here is that cosmic rays not only interact with things in the interstellar medium, when they interact with the Earth's atmosphere, they give us another great result, which indicates neutrino oscillations again. And all the experiments, a number of experiments detecting these atmospheric neutrinos produced by cosmic ray interactions in our Earth's atmosphere have shown that actually mu neutrinos could oscillate into tau neutrinos. Now, in addition to the evidence for neutrino oscillation from both the solar and atmospheric neutrino experiments, there is also yet unconfirmed evidence from the LSND experiment. Well, neutrino oscillation would naturally occur if the neutrino flavor eigenstates are linear superpositions of the mass eigenstates. However, in order to account for all the current indications of oscillations from all these experiments, three very distinct mass squared splittings between different neutrino mass eigenstates are required. And in order to accommodate all these three very distinct mass squared splittings, four distinct neutrino mass eigenstates must be supplied. And four neutrino mass eigenstates obviously would correspond to four neutrino flavors. However, the measurement of the widths of zenith decay tells us that only the electron, muon, and tau neutrino flavors are coupled to the zenith by weak interaction. So if there is a fourth neutrino flavor, this flavor must be sterile and cannot have standard weak interaction. And oscillations of four neutrinos involving a sterile neutrino would have severe consequences for both Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the R process in supernova. As we have discussed in the beginning, current determination of the primordial helium-4 abundance tells us that you cannot have four neutrino species contributing to the energy density of the universe during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And I guess later on you will hear from Kev that how the oscillations involving a sterile neutrino in the early universe would deal with this issue about helium-4 abundance. And here I just would like to concentrate on the problem of the R process in supernova. Well, there are two type of arrangements to accommodate four neutrino mass eigenstates. For example, the highest mass eigenstate can be separated from the rest by the amount indicated by the LSND experiment, for example. And this is a so-called 3+1 scheme. Alternatively, these four mass eigenstates can form two doublets, which are separated from each other by the same amount of mass splitting indicated by the LSND experiment. And this is a so-called 2+2 scheme. Now, in the 3+1 scheme, if the highest mass eigenstates mainly corresponds to the sterile neutrino, it turns out that the electron neutrinos would be converted into the sterile neutrinos through an MSW resonance above the neutron star in supernova. And on the other hand, if the electron neutrino and the sterile neutrino mainly are superpositions of these two lower mass eigenstates in the 2 plus 2 scheme, then it turns out, first, the mu and tau neutrinos would be converted into steroneutrinos by an NSW resonance, and then the electron neutrinos would be converted into mu and tau neutrinos by another MSW resonance above the neutron star in supernova. And in both these cases, the electron neutrino flux above the neutron star is greatly reduced by these oscillations involving steroneutrinos. As we have discussed earlier, the electron neutrinos destroy the neutrons in the neutrino-driven wind, which we think the R process occurred, which place we think that the R process is occurring. However, if this is indeed true, reducing electron neutrino flux would obviously increase the number density of neutrons in the neutrino-driven wind, and therefore could potentially help the R process. Now, however, here is the following. The reduction of the electron neutrino flux above the neutron star may not always be desirable if we think that somehow electron neutrinos are also needed later on to account for some abundance pattern resulting from some kind of R process. This figure shows the abundance pattern of the R process nuclei in the solar system. And the most prominent features of this pattern are the peaks around the mass number 130 and 195. Now, I want to emphasize here is that because the Sun was a relatively young star, many things has happened before it formed. So whatever it collects into, its material, these material is the integration of the products from many supernovae which happened before the Sun was formed. Okay? So this pattern actually represents a mixture of all the patterns produced by many supernovae before the solar system was formed. So in essence, from this pattern, you can't deduce what an individual supernova could have produced. In order to do that, we remember that when the nuclei were first produced by the R process in supernova, these nuclei are very unstable and far away from the stability line. So therefore, in principle, these guys are radioactive. And it turns out some of these nuclei have very long lifetimes. And the two particular nuclei are iodine-129, which will sit later on decay to the nuclei in this 130 peak, and hafnium-182, which sits somewhere over here, right below this 195 peak here. These two nuclei have very long lifetimes of about 10 million years. So therefore, if the last supernova, which happened before the solar system formation, if it occurred within this 10 million year time scale, then if it produced any iodine-129 or hafnium-182, it would survive in the early solar system. And indeed, measurements of meteorites which formed during the early solar system show that abundant hafnium-182 were existing in the early solar system. However, the same kind of measurements showed you that there's very little iodine-129 existing at the same time. What this tells us is that at least in some supernova, in particular that supernova which happened within the last 10 million years also of the solar system formation, that supernova, when it produced the R process, it dominantly only produced the nuclei above mass number 130, including hafnium-182 here, but very little of the nuclei, including iodine-129, around the mass number 130. Now, this piece of information is substantiated also by the observations of abundances in very old stars that were formed in the early history of the galaxy. Now, at very early times, obviously, very few supernovae had time to occur. So these older stars, their abundances would reflect the products only of very few supernovae. And this figure here compares the data on one of the older stars by the name CS22892-052, and the data on this star is compared with the solar R-process abundance pattern, which is shown here as a solid curve over here. And as we can clearly see from this comparison, the elements barium and above, which have mass number above 130 or so, they follow the solar R-process abundance pattern very well. However, the elements such as rhodium and silver, and their mass number is around 100 or so, definitely below mass number 130, these data fall far below the solar R-process abundance pattern. Okay? What's more is that, you know, this is just not a single case, but we know that the data on this CS22892-052 actually are very similar to another star, CS31082-001, as can be seen from this comparison figure over here. And all these things are just plotted as they are, and you can see that within the arrow bars, essentially you cannot distinguish the data set over here. So what these data are telling us is that, you know, we can essentially take the data on these two stars as a representative of a certain kind of R process that produces dominantly the elements barium and above with mass number above 130, and some nuclei, you know, such as strontium all the way to cadmium with mass number below 130. However, remember, the meteoritic measurements tell us no iodine-129 should be produced together with nuclei above mass number 130, including hafnium-182. So therefore, what we are forced to is we have to explain, you have to have some R process which would produce the elements from strontium, you know, with mass number around 90 or so, up to cadmium with mass number around 110 or so. And then you have to skip over those nuclei around mass number 130 and then produce again the elements such as barium and above with mass number 130 and above. Okay? So we have encountered a case of discontinuity over here. How do you do that? Well, if you have friends working at national labs, they will immediately tell you, well, you have to do it by fission. Well, so what I'm going to try to do is to say that in order to produce such a puzzling and a peculiar abundance pattern, you have to invoke fission. Suppose that initially the R process would produce a very smooth and a continuous abundance pattern of the progenitor nuclei, which are obviously initially very unstable, and all these nuclei have mass number above 190 or so, and it is expected when you have such nuclei collected together, produced by the R process, there should be a peak around mass number 195 also, because those nuclei would have closed neutron shells at magic number 126, and these guys are relatively stable, and you tend to produce more of them in the R process. Now, once you produce these nuclei, as they now will successively beta decay towards stability, every bit of the nuclei above mass number 260 would eventually spontaneously fission. Okay? This piece of information, again, comes from friends at the National Lab, because in the early days, they allowed to do the nuclear bomb tests, and they will, you know, do measurements afterwards. What they found is that the heaviest nuclei they would find is always below mass number 260. Nothing above 260 I've ever found after the bomb tests. And the fission of these nuclei above mass number 260 would tend to give one fragment around TIN-132, because this TIN-132 have both closed the neutron shell and proton shells, so doubly magic nuclei. So you tend to produce such a fragment. And since you have initial mass number 260 and above, this tells you the other piece of fragment would end up in a region above mass number 130. Okay? And the nuclei between mass number 230 and 260 will also fission. And they also tend to produce one fragment around TIN-132, and that leaves the other fragment in the region from mass number 100 also up to 130. So just by fission of these two nuclear region, what you can account for is essentially all the elements above mass number 130 and some of the light nuclei from mass number 100 up to 130. However, in this scenario, the nuclei around mass number 130 are not produced very much, simply due to the characteristic of these fission yields. Now, if we go back to the original figure, we also notice that the amount of elements around mass number 90 is very high. If you look at the height of the elements over here, it's comparable to the things around mass number 138 also for barium, and even comparable to the amount of elements in the peak around the mass number 195 also, which is the osmium and the iridium over here. And in order to account for a significant amount of these elements, such as strontium, around mass number 90 also, you cannot just simply rely on fission of these two nuclear regions anymore. You must invoke the fission of the nuclei between mass number 190 and 230. However, these nuclei can fission only after being greatly excited above their ground state. Typical excitation energy is about 30 MeV or so. And you can show it by laboratory experiments, bombarding these with high energy particles. These guys, even actually gold and lead would fission. Okay? And when these guys fission under great excitation, they will tend to fission symmetrically. They just break into two halves. Okay? And so therefore, you will get your mass 90 or so from the fission of these nuclei in the peak. And because there's lots of nuclei in this peak, you also tend to produce lots of the elements around mass 90 also. Okay? And in order to provide such great excitation in supernova, well, a very nice candidate for such an excitation mechanism is just by charge current capture of electron neutrinos. Okay? And obviously, fission is only one of the way for a very neutron-rich nucleus to de-excite. And the other way for such a nucleus to de-excite is to emit neutrons. And we have shown earlier that there are about 5 nuclei from mass number 183 up to mass number 187 also, immediately below mass number 190. The abundances observed in the solar system for these 5 nuclei can be exactly accounted for simply by neutrino-induced neutron emission from the progenitor nuclei residing in this peak around mass number 195. So therefore, we see that electron neutrinos can actually provide a very nice way to account for the final abundance pattern resulting from a certain kind of R process. And if you need these electron neutrinos, then the electron neutrino flux above the neutron star should not be arbitrarily reduced. And obviously, you can be more ingenious. You can say that, how about you invent a scenario where the electron neutrino flux will first be reduced by one kind of MSW resonance, and later on regenerated by some other kind of MSW mechanism, then you can have your cake and eat it too. All right? It's possible. All right? And I'm not to say this is totally out of the question. So the lesson or some kind of a conclusion to take from this discussion is that neutrinos have an intimate role to play in the production of R process nuclei in supernova. And any kind of scenario involving neutrino oscillations should be examined in the full context of this process. So I guess I will just wrap up my talk over here, just to rerun these kind of a summary over here. Now we say that basically, solar neutrinos were produced by the fusion reactions in the sun, and it also gave us a great piece of evidence for oscillations of electron neutrinos into mu and tau neutrinos. And now also this kind of oscillation signal have been confirmed by basically a laboratory experiment, CAMLAND. And mu and tau neutrinos from atmospheric neutrino experiments, these oscillation signals from the atmospheric neutrinos, and it's been tested by the K2K experiment, and also will be checked by another laboratory experiment, MINOS. And obviously, if we also say that the LSNE result must be true, then that must require some kind of a stereoneutrino to be incorporated into the general scheme of neutrino oscillations. And obviously, we don't have to take take for granted, this LSN result will be confirmed or refuted by the Mini-Bohm experiment. And even when we are waiting for the results from these future experiments, we already discovered that the same kind of neutrino oscillation schemes could be probed by at least two astrophysical environments. One is the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Hopefully, Kev will tell you more about it later. And the other one is what I talked about, the supernova upper-crust nucleosynthesis. So I just stop here.
Thank you very much. We have time for one or two questions.
Curious, if you want to know about the arc process from supernova, why don't people look at supernova remnants?
Well, there's many ways to think about it. The remnant you're going to see now is basically very young, within several 10,000 years or so. And the material already out there in the interstellar medium has been accumulating all the past 10 billion years or so. One supernova would put out some fresh stuff, okay, but it will be mixed up with the things already existing there. So it will be submerged. That's true, that's what I'm saying. But before Crab was formed, the material already been cycling through that area for many, many years. So you have had accumulated contribution from many, many past supernova in that region. You add another supernova there, it won't stand out.
You can't separate.
The only way you separate it out is that you have radioactive nuclei, because all the past guys has been dead, right? So if you have some radioactive nuclei produced fresh by the fresh supernova, and one of my favorite ways to test these R-process scenario is basically to look for the nuclear gamma rays when these guys decay. And that requires a very sensitive gamma ray instrument. You know, you should be able, if you want to detect those kind of fluxes, your sensitivity is something like a 10 to the minus 7 photons per centimeter squared per second. It's a very, very high sensitive experiment.
The cross sections are huge, and when you split the nucleus into two pieces, since you already start with a very neutron-rich nucleus, the two fragments you produce are just incredibly neutron-rich.
Right.
So they're going to fragment and evaporate all sorts of neutrons, and you should produce a very strange distribution of final nuclei. Is there any way that we could, Los Alamos, I know, has codes.
We both go back to talk to all the friends.
Yes. Do we have codes that can actually do this sort of calculation with these exotic masses that could be involved?
It could be, but the other way is also obviously the concomitant effects of fission. Basically, you release 200 MeV per fission, and you might be heating up the material, and also fission release neutrons. These neutrons somehow will be recaptured too. Actually, there is also another evidence. I sort of didn't have time to cover is the following, that there's all kind of weird atomic and nuclear physics over here. Barium has three isotopes, 135, 137, and 138. And only 135 and 137 would have nuclear magnetic moment, so to give you fine structure, hyperfine structure splitting in atomic spectra. 138 won't. And so if you have a very high resolution spectra of the atomic lines due to barium, and you can see that whether there's hyperfine splitting there. And turns out, in one particular star where they have high signal-to-noise ratio, this barium essentially is sitting at 138. There's no 135 and 138, 7 there. Now imagine, 137 and 138 are just missing by one mass unit, but you drop like a rock. So that essentially is telling you, you know, the region over here is just really like a really big dip over there. And the way to force this dip is actually you recapture neutrons somehow and to rush up this material piling up at the barium 138, which has a magic neutron shell. So all sorts of things would happen. And I'm basically just fantasizing over here. You know, some people should do much more serious work to confirm or refine the scenario. Okay, George?
Right.
Yeah, I should mention one thing is that Peter had mentioned Ingram and Reynolds measuring the double beta decay experiment using the geochemical thing. The same guys measured the iodine valence in the early solar system. So, names were very familiar.
Okay. I was just going to ask, I'm intrigued by these two peaks you showed in one of the earlier figures at
130
and 195.
Right.
Could you imagine some highly simplified model?
Yeah, it's
would give you that feature?
That's and easy because
is it related in any way to the issue of the neutrino mass spectrum?
No, it's basically it's purely due to nuclear physics. The 130 guy, because what happens is that when you are running the R process, you go into I should have a figure somewhere. Okay, here you go. So if you actually think about how you're going to run the R process, you're going to run it far away from stability, okay? So you're going to essentially encounter the magic neutron shell 82 somewhere. And in the stable case, magic neutron number 82 is at proton number 56. But if you are running on the neutron-rich side, you're going to encounter this earlier. And so that's essentially around at 48 or so. You add that up as a mass number 130. Whereas the neutron magic shell at the 126, if it's stable, you run at it proton number 82, but if you do it in very neutron-rich conditions, you run it at proton number 69, which gives you 195. So those are the natural explanation for the existence of these two peaks.
Thank the speaker once again.